A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and the timing couldn't be more on the nose. As of today, the ceasefire with Iran is fraying. Jets over Jerusalem. Drone attacks on a UAE. Tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. Trump reviewing Iran's 14-point proposal and publicly doubting it's acceptable. Daniel's asking, essentially, what does it actually look like to upgrade your readiness posture without spiraling into anxiety? He wants the practical walkthrough. Situational awareness, news monitoring that doesn't eat your brain, go bag checks, household standard operating procedures, and the mental discipline of staying calibrated. Not alarmist, just deliberate.
That last part, staying calibrated, that's the one that separates actual preparedness from performative doom scrolling. I've been thinking about this all morning, especially after hearing those jets. By the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro.
Welcome aboard, DeepSeek. Alright, so where do we start? There's a lot here, and I think the order matters. You don't start with the go bag, you start with your head.
You absolutely start with your head. And I want to frame this around something specific that's happening right now that most people aren't registering properly. This isn't a return to full-scale war, and it isn't peace. It's this ambiguous middle zone. The ceasefire technically holds, but you've got kinetic action. The UAE accused Iran of a terrorist attack today, May 4th, using two drones against an ADNOC oil tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. That's a real escalation, but it's not the same as the bombing campaign we saw in February and March. This in-between space is exactly where anxiety thrives, because your brain doesn't know which script to run.
Your threat response system wants clarity. Am I in danger right now or not? An ambiguity is harder to process than a clear yes or no. So step one in the mental piece is naming that. Just saying, okay, the reason I feel unsettled is that the situation is objectively unsettled. That's not a failure of your coping skills. That's your brain accurately reading the environment.
Then the question becomes, what do I do with that accurate reading? Because accurate doesn't mean actionable if you don't channel it. This is where I think Daniel's framing is smart. He's not asking how to feel better. He's asking what a deliberate posture upgrade looks like. Deliberate is the operative word. It's the opposite of reactive.
Let's get concrete. Situational awareness. What does that actually mean for someone in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or Haifa right now today?
First thing, I'd say situational awareness is not the same as news consumption. Most people conflate them. They think being aware means having the news on in the background all day. That's not awareness, that's ambient anxiety. Real situational awareness has three layers. Layer 1, official channels that actually change your behavior. Homefront Command app, their Telegram channel, the municipal alert systems. These tell you if your area's activity status changes, if there are gathering restrictions, if shelter open times update. On May 1st, Homefront Command updated the defense policy for communities along the Lebanon border, Meron, Bar Yochai, or Haganuz, Safsufa, moving them from full activity to partial activity through today. That's the kind of granular, localized change that matters. Most of the country remained on full activity. If you live in Jerusalem, that's a data point that helps you calibrate.
The signal isn't just the change, it's also the absence of change. The fact that most of the country wasn't restricted is itself information.
And most people miss that because the headlines don't lead with most areas unchanged. They lead with the restriction. So layer 1 is official channels that dictate your actual constraints. Layer 2 is what I call threat-specific awareness. And this is where things have shifted in the past few months in ways that most civilian guidance hasn't caught up with.
You're talking about drones.
I'm talking about drones. The Times of Israel had a piece today about Hezbollah using fiber-optic-guided FPV drones against IDF. Troops in southern Lebanon. One soldier killed and three wounded on April 30th, 12 wounded in an earlier attack. These are jamming-resistant, cheap, and small. Israel's air defense architecture was built around rockets and missiles, larger radar cross-sections, predictable trajectories. A fiber-optic drone doesn't emit radio signals you can jam, and it can be flown low and slow. The IDFF itself admits it lacks ready countermeasures.
For a civilian, what does drone-specific awareness even look like? You're not going to spot a small drone from your balcony before it hits something.
No, you're not. But the awareness shift is about understanding that the threat profile has changed. The old model was, hear a siren, you have somewhere between 15 and 90 seconds depending on your proximity to the border, you go to your shelter. Drones don't give you a siren. The awareness piece here is less about individual detection and more about understanding that when tensions spike, like they are right now, a drone incursion could happen without warning, and your response time is essentially zero. That changes how you think about where you are and what you're doing.
Which sounds terrifying if you just leave it there. But I think the practical translation is simpler than people think. It means, during high-tension periods, know where the nearest protected space is even when you're not at home. If you're at a cafe, glance around. If you're at a park with your kid, note the nearest building. Not obsessively, just once when you arrive.
It's a habit, not a state of hypervigilance. You're not scanning the sky. You're just doing a 2-second mental note when you enter a new space. That's layer 2. Layer 3 is community-level awareness. Your building's WhatsApp group, your neighborhood emergency coordinator if you have one, your workplace security protocols. These are the channels where you'll hear things like, jets overhead are ours, routine patrol, versus unusual activity, shelter in place. And you don't need to read every message. You need to have notifications on for the coordinator and maybe skim once in the morning.
Alright, that's a useful framework. 3 layers. Official channels that dictate constraints. Threat-specific awareness that shapes your mental model. And community-level awareness that gives you ground truth. Now, let's talk about the news consumption piece. Because this is where I think most people, myself included, can get pulled into the undertow.
This is the one I get asked about most. And I think the standard advice of limit your news intake is correct, but incomplete. It's not just about quantity, it's about structure and intentionality. So here's what I'd recommend as a practical protocol for a period like this, where things are actively developing, but not at full-scale war. 2 scheduled check-ins per day, morning maybe 7:30 or 8, and evening around 6 or 7.
Why those times?
Morning gives you the overnight developments, and in this region, a lot happens while we sleep because of time zones. Evening gives you the day's wrap before you wind down. The key is, these are bounded. You're not checking at 10 a.m., then 11, then again at 11:30 because you saw a headline. You're training yourself to batch, and during each check-in, you're not scrolling an infinite feed. You pick 3 sources, you read them top to bottom, or at least the top stories, and then you close them. Depends on the person, but my template would be 1 Israeli source for domestic and security updates, Times of Israel or Haaretz or Winnet, whatever you trust. 1 international source for the broader diplomatic picture. I find the wire services like Reuters or AP are best for this because they're less editorialized. And then 1 official channel, IDFF, spokesperson or home front command, for direct operational updates that might affect you. That's it. 3 sources, twice a day, probably 20 minutes total per session.
The rest of the day?
The rest of the day, you're not a passive consumer of whatever the algorithm serves you. If a major development happens, and I mean major, like sirens in your city or an official escalation announcement, you'll know. Someone will tell you. Your phone will buzz. You don't need to be the first person to know. You need to be the person who can respond calmly when it's time to respond.
There's a deeper thing here, too, which is that a lot of what passes for staying informed is actually just seeking reassurance. You're not learning anything new on the 5th refresh of the same live blog. You're checking to see if the world still feels stable. And when it doesn't, because the news is unsettling, you check again, hoping for a different feeling. That's the doom scroll loop.
The loop is self-reinforcing because occasionally you do get a new piece of information that momentarily satisfies the urge. That intermittent reinforcement is exactly what makes it addictive. So breaking it requires a structural intervention, not just willpower. Scheduled check-ins are the structural intervention. You're not denying yourself information. You're actually getting better information because you're reading deliberately instead of grazing.
Let's move to the physical preparedness stuff. I'll admit mine has been sitting in the closet for probably 8 months, and I haven't thought about it.
You're not alone. And this is where the posture upgrade framing is useful, because it's not an emergency. You're not throwing things into a bag while sirens are going off. You're doing a deliberate audit on a Sunday afternoon. So let's walk through what a go bag check actually entails. First, and this is the thing most people skip, pull everything out. Don't just peek inside and say, looks fine. Empty it completely. Because things expire, things get musty, things get borrowed and not replaced. Snacks turn into archaeology. And also because you need to reevaluate whether what you packed a year ago still makes sense. Your life changes. Maybe you now have a kid. Maybe you take medication you didn't take before. Maybe it's summer now and you packed winter clothes. Empty the bag, lay it all out, and go through it item by item.
What's the actual checklist?
I break it into categories. Documents, copies of IDs, passports, insurance cards, medical records. These should be physical copies, not just on your phone. A USB. Drive with scanned versions is fine as backup, but assume you might not have power or internet. Cash, small bills, enough for a few days of basics. Medications, at minimum a 3-day supply of anything you take regularly, plus a list of what you take and your prescribing doctor's contact info. First aid basics, bandages, antiseptic, pain relievers, any specific items for your household's needs.
Then the non-medical stuff.
Water, at least 3 liters per person, non-perishable food, high-calorie, no-prep stuff, protein bars, nuts, dried fruit, a flashlight with fresh batteries, check the batteries, a phone charger and a power bank, and charge the power bank, because if it's been sitting for 8 months, it's probably dead, a change of clothes, including sturdy shoes, a basic hygiene kit, something to keep you occupied if you're in a shelter for hours, a book, a deck of cards, whatever. And if you have kids, age-appropriate items, diapers, formula, a small toy, or comfort object.
The kid stuff is easy to overlook. Ezra's what, almost 2 now? The go bag that made sense for an infant doesn't make sense for a toddler.
Diaper sizes change, formula needs change, the comfort object changes. If you packed a go bag a year ago and haven't touched it, and you have a young child, it's almost certainly wrong now. So the posture upgrade isn't just a check, it's a reevaluation.
There's a seasonal component too. It's May. You don't need the heavy coat and thermal layers you packed in October, but you do need some protection, maybe a hat, lighter clothing.
Seasonal rotation is part of the discipline. I tell people to do it when the clocks change, spring forward, fall back, go bag check, twice a year minimum. But if you haven't done it since the fall, now's the time.
All right, so go bags are done. Let's talk about household SOPs, standard operating procedures. This sounds like corporate jargon, but I actually think it's the right framing for families.
It is, because the point of an SOP is that you don't have to think in the moment. The thinking has already been done. You've made the decisions in advance, when you're calm and not under time pressure. For a household, the core SOPs are, what do we do if there's a siren? What do we do if there's an alert but no siren? What do we do if we're not all together? What do we do if communications go down?
Let's take those one at a time. The siren one, most Israelis know, but I think there's value in actually talking it through with your household, not just assuming everyone's on the same page.
Especially if you have kids. A 4-year-old doesn't internalize, go to the shelter, the same way an adult does. They need to have practiced it, and they need to understand it in a way that doesn't terrify them. The framing matters. You're not saying, we practice this because something bad might happen. You're saying, this is what we do to stay safe, just like we wear seatbelts. It's a family drill, not a fear rehearsal.
The drill should be specific to your actual home. Which room do you go to? Who grabs the kid? Who grabs a go bag? Who closes the windows? If you have pets, who's responsible for the cat or the dog? These are decisions you make once, not in the 15 seconds after the siren starts.
The second SOP, alert without siren. This is increasingly relevant with the drone threat. If you get a home front command notification that says suspected infiltration or hostile aircraft, you may not hear a siren. The protocol should be the same. Go to the protected space, stay there until the all clear. But everyone in the household needs to know that the phone notification carries the same weight as a siren. You don't wait to hear it. You don't go outside to look.
The third one, not all together. This is where a lot of families have a gap. If you're at work and your spouse is home with the kids, or the kids are at school, what's the plan? Who contacts whom? Is there a designated meeting point if you can't reach each other?
The designated meeting point should be specific and known to everyone old enough to understand it. Not, we'll meet at home. What if home isn't accessible? Pick a secondary location. A relative's house, a community center, a specific landmark. And have a communication protocol. If phone lines are jammed, text messages often still go through when calls won't. If neither works, have a fallback. A third party outside the immediate area who can relay messages. An aunt in another city, a friend abroad.
The out-of-area contact is an underrated piece of emergency planning. When local networks are congested, a call to someone in a different region or country will often connect fine, and they can coordinate between separated family members.
It's a simple thing that most people don't set up in advance. Takes 5 minutes. If we can't reach each other, we both call Uncle David in London, and he'll relay messages. Now you have a protocol.
The fourth one. Communications down entirely. This is the hardest scenario, but worth at least the conversation. If there's no cell service, no internet, no landline, what's the default assumption? Do you stay put? Do you make your way to the meeting point? How long do you wait before moving?
The default should be stay put for a defined period, say 2 hours, and if no contact by then, move to the designated meeting point, and leave a note if you leave home, paper on the door or the refrigerator. Low tech, but it works when everything else is down.
All right, so we've covered situational awareness, news discipline, go bags, household SOPs. Let's get to the last piece that Daniel mentioned, which is the mental discipline of staying calibrated. I think this is actually the hardest one, because it's not a checklist. It's an ongoing practice.
It's the one that makes all the others work. You can have the best go bag in the world, but if you're in a state of constant panic, you're not going to use it effectively. So let me offer a few things that I found actually help, both from my time practicing medicine here and from the research on stress and resilience. First, distinguish between what you can control and what you can't, and then focus relentlessly on the former. It sounds like self-help cliche, but there's a reason it's the backbone of every evidence-based anxiety intervention. You can't control whether Iran's 14-point proposal gets accepted. You can't control what Trump tweets. You can't control whether Hezbollah launches a drone. You can control whether your go bag is packed, whether your family knows the plan, whether you've charged your phone, whether you've done your 2 scheduled news check-ins and then closed the browser.
The checklist we just walked through is essentially a list of things you can control. So doing the checklist isn't just practical. It's psychologically protective. Every item you check off is a signal to your brain that you've done what you can do.
Action is an antidote to helplessness. Not frantic action, deliberate, methodical action. The go bag audit, the family drill, the contact list update. These are grounding precisely because they're mundane. They remind you that most of life, even during a crisis, is about basic, practical things. Watch your physical baseline. Sleep, food, movement. When people are anxious, the first thing that goes is sleep. They stay up reading news. They wake up at 3 a.m. and check their phone. Sleep deprivation amplifies anxiety and impairs decision-making. So protecting your sleep during a tense period is not a luxury. It's a readiness measure. No screens in the bedroom, no news for at least an hour before bed, and if you wake up in the night, do not check your phone. That's a hard rule.
That's the one I break most often. 3 a.m., wake up, reach for the phone before I've even consciously decided to. It's a reflex.
It's a reflex for a lot of people. The fix is mechanical, not willpower-based. Put your phone in another room. Buy an alarm clock. If you need your phone for the home front command alerts, put it on the other side of the room so you can't reach it from bed, and set it to do not disturb with exceptions only for emergency alerts.
Food and movement?
Eat actual meals at actual mealtimes. When people are stressed, they either undereat or eat junk. Both mess with your blood sugar and your mood stability. And movement, you don't need to run a marathon. A 20-minute walk, some stretching, anything that gets you out of your head and into your body. It's not about fitness, it's about regulating your nervous system.
There's a social piece too, I think. Isolation amplifies anxiety. When you're alone with your thoughts in a newsfeed, everything feels bigger and more imminent.
Talk to people. Not about the news, about normal things. Call a friend and talk about their garden or their kid or a book they're reading. Go to synagogue or a community event if that's your thing. The goal is to stay embedded in normal life, not to withdraw into a bunker mentality. The bunker mentality is corrosive. It shrinks your world down to the threat, and then the threat is everything.
Ironically, that makes you less safe, not more. Because you're less connected to the people who would help you in an actual emergency. Your neighbors, your community, your family, those relationships are part of your readiness infrastructure.
Community is not a soft factor. It's a hard resilience asset. During the Second Lebanon War, during the rocket attacks from Gaza, the communities that held up best weren't necessarily the ones with the best shelters. They were the ones where people knew each other, checked on each other, shared resources. I saw this firsthand in my practice. Patients who were socially connected had better outcomes across the board, lower anxiety, better adherence to safety protocols, faster psychological recovery afterward.
The calibration piece is really about maintaining your life, not putting it on hold. The news wants you to believe that everything has changed and normal life is suspended. But for most people, most of the time, even during a conflict, normal life continues. Kids go to school, people go to work, you make dinner, you go for a walk. The discipline is in holding those things as real and important, not as distractions from the real story.
That's not denial. Denial would be pretending there's no threat. Calibration is acknowledging the threat, doing what you reasonably can to prepare, and then living your life. It's the middle path between panic and complacency.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about the drones, because I think it connects to the calibration question in a specific way. The drone threat is new and unsettling, and it's easy to let it dominate your mental landscape because it feels undefendable. But the actual probability of any individual civilian being hit by a drone in Jerusalem today is extremely low. Calibration means holding both of those things at once. It's a real shift in the threat environment, and it's still a very low personal risk.
This is where numeracy helps, and most people don't get this from the news. The news reports incidents. A drone strike here, a soldier killed there, and your brain treats each incident as evidence of escalating personal danger. But that's not how probability works. The fact that something happens somewhere doesn't mean it's likely to happen to you. The actual base rates matter. And the base rate for civilian drone casualties in central Israel right now is very low.
The emotional weight of the drone narrative is high, because it's new, and because it feels like something we can't protect against, so people over-index on it.
Which is why the calibration discipline includes being aware of your own cognitive biases. Availability bias, we overestimate the probability of things that are vivid and recent in our memory. Salience bias, we overweight dramatic threats and underweight mundane ones. Just knowing that your brain does this helps you correct for it. You can say to yourself, okay, I'm feeling anxious about drones because the news is full of drone stories, but the actual risk to me and my family right now is still low, and I've done what I can do.
All right, let's pull this together into something someone can actually use. If I'm listening to this and I want to do a readiness posture upgrade this week, what's my Monday through Sunday?
Day 1. Today, if you're listening when this comes out, do the mental inventory. Name the ambiguity, commit to the deliberate approach, set up your news protocol. Delete news apps from your phone if you need to, or at least turn off notifications. Decide on your 2 check-in times and your 3 sources. That's it for day 1. You're not buying anything, you're not packing anything, you're setting the frame.
Day 2, go bag on it. Empty it. Lay it out, check everything, replace what's expired, update what's changed. If you don't have a go bag, day 2 is when you start one. Even a basic one is better than nothing.
Day 3, household SOPs. Sit down with your family, or if you live alone, just write it down for yourself. Where do you go for each type of alert? Who does what? What's the communication plan? What's the meeting point? Talk through the scenarios calmly, answer questions, keep it age appropriate for kids.
Day 4, practice. Actually, walk through the drill once. See if anything doesn't work. Maybe the go bag is too heavy. Maybe the shelter door sticks. Maybe the kid panics. Better to find out on a practice run than in the real thing.
Day 5, community connection. Check in with a neighbor, especially if they're elderly or live alone. Make sure you're in the building WhatsApp group if there is one. Exchange phone numbers with someone nearby who can check on you if something happens. This is also the day to identify your out-of-area contact and make sure they know they're your out-of-area contact.
Day 6. Physical baseline check. How's your sleep been? Are you eating? Are you moving? Make one adjustment. Maybe that's putting your phone in another room at night, or committing to a walk after dinner, or actually sitting down for lunch instead of eating over the sink.
Day 7. Rest. Do something normal. Something that has nothing to do with readiness or news or the situation. Watch a movie, read a novel, cook something elaborate, take the kids to a park. The point is to practice living your life fully, not in a holding pattern.
I like that day 7 is rest. It makes the whole thing feel sustainable. This isn't boot camp. It's a rhythm.
The rhythm is the whole point. Readiness isn't a one-time event. It's a posture, something you maintain, not something you achieve. The weekly check-in becomes a habit. The go bag gets refreshed seasonally. The family drill gets practiced every few months, and most of the time you're just living your life because most of the time the worst doesn't happen.
If it does, you're not scrambling. You've already done the thinking. Your family knows the plan. Your bag is packed. Your phone is charged. You can focus on what actually needs your attention in the moment, instead of trying to figure everything out from scratch while your heart is pounding.
That's the whole thing in a sentence. Preparedness buys you bandwidth. When you've already made the decisions, you free up your brain to handle the unexpected, the thing you couldn't plan for, and that's where resilience actually lives.
One last thing before we wrap. For people who are feeling the weight of this, and I think that's a lot of people right now, there's something important about not pathologizing a normal response to an abnormal situation. Feeling anxious when jets are flying low over your city, and a ceasefire is fraying and drones are hitting tankers in the strait. That's not a disorder. That's a human being with a functioning threat detection system.
The goal isn't to feel nothing. The goal is to feel what you feel and still function. To say, yes, this is unsettling, and I'm going to make dinner anyway. I'm going to help my kid with homework. I'm going to do my job. I'm going to check my go bag and then close the closet door and not think about it until the next rotation. That's calibration. It's not about being fearless. It's about not letting fear run the show.
Now, Wilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs about 1.1 million pounds, roughly the same as 200 elephants, and stays aloft because the weight is spread across millions of tiny water droplets that are each lighter than the surrounding air.
200 elephants just floating over our heads. If there's one thing I'd leave people with, it's that readiness isn't about predicting the future. It's about being able to meet whatever comes without having to figure yourself out first. That's worth doing even if nothing happens. Especially if nothing happens.
The news will keep being what it is. The 14-point proposal will get reviewed or rejected or revised. The jets will fly or they won't. What you can do today is the same as what you could do yesterday and what you'll be able to do tomorrow. Take care of your people, get your house in order, and stay connected to the life you're actually living, not just the one being broadcast.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
If you haven't already, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Spotify, Apple, wherever. We're there.
We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.